Win more listings and sell more listings with Realtor.com's Listing Toolkit. Most agents get their first seller lead within 3 days of activating their account. So get Listing Toolkit at Realtor.com/HousingWire. Welcome, everyone. My guest today is Managing Editor James Kleiman to talk about the legal and practical challenges of dual licensing for real estate agents and loan officers. I want to thank our podcast sponsor, Vesta, for making this episode possible. James, welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, good to be back.
And thanks for taking over when I was out sick. I always appreciate that.
Sure. Apologies to everybody. My audio did not turn out so great. So I think we've fixed the issue for today, but apologies for hearing my voice at such a difficult volume with such pitch.
You know, I always wonder, I know people listen to podcasts at different speeds. And so I'm like, who knows what our voice actually sounds like to them anyway? Like they might have it on like two. Our topic today, super hot topic, very controversial, very interesting to people on the real estate and the mortgage side, and that is dual licensing. So you have worked with Flavia Furlan-Nunez, our senior reporter, on this feature. And so very interested to dive in here. Kind of give us the backdrop. What is dual licensing?
Yeah. So I've been working on this story with Berkeley Hahn, real estate reporter at HousingWire, and Flavia Furlan-Nunez. And this is not a new phenomenon per se. An agent or an LO has had the ability for some years now to operate in a dual capacity, right? So if you're a loan originator, you can work as an LO and you can also get your real estate license and work on deals on either the sell side or the buy side. And similarly, if you're a real estate agent, you can get your mortgage loan originator's license and you can work on deals as well. And pretty recently, the FHA decided policy-wise that there was no conflict in having someone be able to work in both capacities and receive commission on a deal as both an agent and an originator. And there haven't been any restrictions on Fannie and Freddie loans. And so really what we've seen is an acceleration in people who are interested in doing both. I don't know that I would say there is a huge upswing in people who are practicing dual licensing necessarily. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the reasons why, but there is a pretty high barrier to entry, not just in terms of licensing, but if I asked you, Sarah, to also be beyond being an excellent news manager and content producer, but maybe you're also now in charge of sales at HousingWire, it would be really, really hard. Maybe you'd be good at elements of both jobs. Maybe you'd be really good at one and not as good at the other. Maybe you'd be pretty decent at one and great at the other. You know, and that's going to depend on an individual skill set and experience and ability to kind of tackle unique situations that they've never come across before. I think it's fair to say a lot of people don't have the innate ability to do two distinct jobs at a really high level. And especially in a marketplace like we're in currently, in which I think this is a marketplace of skills, and I said that yesterday during the podcast. And if you're a below average originator and an okay real estate agent, I don't think that you offer enough value to any client. And so for most people, I think you probably would rather be a really good LO or a really good agent. But certainly there is a big increase in people who want to at least explore whether dual licensing makes sense. And I think it really comes down to the thing it usually comes down to, right? Which is money. And there are fewer deals to be done in a market like this. Not a lot of existing home sales right now. Hopefully it's a little better than last year, but rates are really high. It's a tough market. And look, if you can get 250 basis points as a buy side agent, and you can also handle the origination component of it, and maybe you tack on an extra 150 bips on a $400,000 deal, you're making, you know, more than $10,000. And that can really be the difference between you having a pretty good month and having nothing, right? And so there are a lot of people now who I think are saying, you know, I want to at least look into it. I want to do it. I haven't seen anything at scale There are definitely a couple companies that are trying, but no one's there yet.
And the backdrop, of course, is that we have all this potential changes to the way that, you know, buy-side agents are going to be contracted with, how they're going to be paid, what that looks like, who is going to get to the buyer first. And if you are the lender and you can figure this out, I feel like there is an advantage there that, like, hey, I can offer you not only to be the agent, but then to be the lender. Given, you know, what you said, though, you know, it just from a time perspective, it seems challenging, right? Maybe if you have so little volume, but how do you, I mean, agents do a lot, especially buyer's agents do a lot of driving around and going. I mean, it's a very time intensive job sometimes, don't you think?
I do. I think that you could probably work as a dual agent. Let's say you're a solid performer as an agent and you're a pretty solid, you know, let's say in like the 75th percentile on both, you know, not like exceptional, not in the 1%, but also not someone who's doing a deal every couple of years, right? Let's say you're a solid producer on both. I think you probably start in most cases getting the lead initially from an online source or, you know, a referral source that is not another agent. And you get to that consumer first, and they probably don't have a pre-qual. They probably haven't already talked to somebody in the financing. And so your pitch is probably, hey, you know, I know you can get into a $500,000 house. I know your finances. I'm able to, you know, get that loan done for you. But also, if you don't, are you already working with a real estate agent? You're not. Okay. It just so happens I am also a licensed real estate agent, and I can be the single point of contact. I am able to handle pretty much every aspect of the job for you. Now, I think if you're the person who is, you know, working in a dual capacity, you want to think about a couple things, right? You don't want to be driving around aimlessly to 50 open houses and, you know, doing all the labor, the manual labor that comes often with being a buy-side agent. So I think you probably have to self-select. Now, I talked to a guy in New Jersey who is both, he's a successful originator. He's been an LO since 1999. He got his real estate license in 2014. And he has both a mortgage brokerage, and he also has a real estate brokerage that he opened up in 2019. And he's among the very few people in New Jersey who does, you know, work as both an agent and an LO. He only, and again, this is one of the few people out there in, you know, a pretty hot market. Only about 20% of his deals is he working in a dual capacity. So in most of them, he's working as an LO. In some, he's working as either a sell side agent or on the buy side. But it's not like this is the model that, you know, he can basically say, I'm going to do this on every deal. And that's because, well, there are a couple reasons, but the big one is the agent on the other side of the table is going to view him as a competitor. And so he told me that there are definitely other agents out there who say they will not use him as an originator, right? And he has to think about that. And that's one of the major challenges. If you are exploring dual licensing as an originator, are you cannibalizing your own business by, you know, however one defines it, but, you know, certainly a lot of realtors in the marketplace are going to say you're a competitor and I don't want to work with you in any capacity, but if I have to work with you as an agent, like, that's fine, but I'm not also going to send you business for you to, you know, take my clients down the line or compete with me for, you know, however many deals are out there in the market. So that's one of the major challenges. And we spoke to a couple people who thought there's more potential for scale as an agent who can also handle a couple deals on the LO side. But keep in mind, there is a higher barrier to entry to become an originator than there is an agent. You know, just the licensing requirements are a lot tougher. The test, I think it's fair to say, is a little bit more difficult. You have to know a lot of different products and be able to handle a lot of situations, and not everybody's cut out for that.
Hey Hey, mortgage and banking leaders, your customers need home insurance. Matic works with over 100 financial institutions to integrate their digital insurance marketplace into the home buying and ownership experience. Customers can shop 50 carriers and find a policy in minutes. It's a great way to create a new revenue stream that boosts customer happiness. Learn more at go.matic.com/HW. That's go.matic.com/HW. Really, that is a huge issue. And it reminds me, you know, oftentimes when we talk to brokers, you know, having gone to the AIM conference before, for instance, and sitting in the conference and that's the Association of Independent Mortgage Experts, do I have that right? It's basically a lot of mortgage brokers. Many, many of them were sourced from the real estate field. Like they had their real estate license, they became brokers. But you and I have heard from both sides. I think both sides can take, one of the reasons this is controversial is whether you're an agent or a loan officer, you can feel like, listen, buddy, you don't know what you need to know to do this effectively. If you think this is so easy, you know, you're about to get in trouble with, you know, regulators or with, so I feel like we've heard that from both. We've heard that from realtors saying, you know, they have no idea. And then you hear it from loan officers who are like, you know, they're not used to this level of scrutiny on the regulatory side. What did you find out there?
It's definitely, there are a lot of gray areas depending on who you speak with. So during the course of our reporting, we did speak with a couple folks who work as attorneys in the mortgage compliance space, who really specialize in RESPA. And I think there are a couple things to know here. The first is a lot of the do's and don'ts will depend heavily on the state that you're in. There are a couple states that really don't even permit dual licensing. And so it's, gosh, I think one of them is Utah. I want to say Louisiana. I'll have to go back and check and look into this. But it's not like you can do this in every state. So that's the first part of it. The second is you can't have a situation where you have someone who is essentially a patsy is maybe the wrong word, but sort of... you know, someone who's operating in the capacity only to funnel leads, who's not actually handling the loan or handling the paperwork or the deal as an agent. So if you're an originator and you have, someone who technically has a real estate license, but really it's effectively just a kickback, right? Trying to get you more basis points by operating on both the real estate side and the mortgage origination side. And you're not really meaningfully working the deal. I think that's where you could see a lot of problems with the CFPB, even potentially state regulators, if they wake up. But again, we don't see a lot of companies really doing this right now. We've heard of a couple that in the wake of the Sitzer-Burnett verdict and the subsequent proposed settlement agreement, a lot of companies are now looking at this and saying, okay, if the buy side agent is not really as secure a position, maybe this is an opportunity for us to provide an in-house real estate agent, and they'll collect maybe even a flat fee, maybe an hourly rate, maybe, you know, there are a lot of different ways that one could do it. And then we also have an in-house originator. Is that dramatically different from a lot of the big JVs that we have between, just as an example, Compass and G-Rate, or, you know, there are a million of them, right? So that's really not that different. I mean, it is a separate company. It is not, legally speaking, one and the same, but it is all about the capture rate, right? And so all of these companies are thinking about, how do we get directly to the borrower, and can we capture more of the potential revenue? And so you see it on the real estate brokerage side. A lot of these companies have partnerships or a JV or an MSA with, let's say, a title company or a mortgage company, right? And the whole purpose of this is to have as much money as the middleman or a middleman in these transactions as possible. I think real estate brokerage has done a little bit better a job in capturing this slice of revenue than they have on the mortgage side. And mortgage is a lot more heavily regulated. And that's one of the reasons why. And certainly there are a lot of people who are very careful about the relationships and the RESPA compliance elements of these JVs, you know, you don't just set one up one day and say, okay, like let's funnel some business through this widget. But definitely it's legal. And it's only legal if you do it right. And so I would think that a lot of operators would want to be heavily cautious. However, as we know, Sarah, when we get into markets in which people aren't making money, people aren't doing deals, there's more that there's a greater likelihood that there are going to be people who cut corners and who maybe don't do it by the book.
Yeah. And I mean, even some of the agents said that they wouldn't be comfortable doing it. Like they felt like it was a conflict of interest.
Yeah. I mean, that's certainly a perspective. I think if you ask, let's say 10 average agents in America, people who are actual real producers, not just, you know, Aunt Betty, who's doing a deal every couple of years or whatever. I think if you ask 10 of them, 8 of them would say, I don't want to do that. I'm not going to pursue also being an originator, even if a lot of, you know, pretty straightforward deals with clients wouldn't require more than a cursory understanding of Encompass and some basic guidelines. And, you know, you put the numbers in through DU and it tells you whether the loan is conforming and Fannie or Freddie will buy it. And, you know, there's your 150 basis points for not a lot of effort. I just don't think a lot of agents would want to do that. I think this will continue to be a business that is also really difficult to scale. And I think a lot of companies would struggle doing it in a meaningful way, but that won't stop them from trying. You know, when you're staring at potentially 7.5% rates for another couple quarters, you have to explore other options, right? And if this is one that is available, maybe that changes your calculation from losing, you know, $5 million a year to making a dollar, and that might be enough.
That might be enough. You know, you mentioned the story, or someone mentions in the story, that the fact that agents act as a fiduciary. I think that's how you say it. But I think it's interesting that they say that, but then think that the LOs aren't acting in that capacity. I don't know if they say it that way. I don't know if it's
That's illegal.
Outline that saying. Okay. So tell me what part of that doesn't apply to a mortgage loan officer.
Lenders are not fiduciaries. Mortgage lenders are not fiduciaries to the borrowers. And so that is one of the major differences. And, you know, also philosophically, how one serves client. I think that if you are a really good LO or lender and your best interest, and it should be your best interest to serve the client most effectively and to not steer them to products that might give you higher comp, even if it's not a better deal for the client. But legally speaking, as the CFPB and the government looks at it, the mortgage lender is not a fiduciary. They do not have to act in the pure best interest of the consumer at every turn. The realtor, and you know, I don't know how often there are cases in which the realtor does not act as a fiduciary, even if they're legally expected and required to. At the end of the day, we don't see a tremendous amount of enforcement. We don't see a lot of compliance measures. And when there are testers, when there are examples where real estate agents have the option to best serve the client or to potentially steer them, there are studies that say they do. And so are they always acting as a fiduciary because the legalities say they have to? Or are loan officers conversely not, even though, or are they, even though they don't have to? You know, it's so hard to know. But I do think that for the vast majority of producing originators and real estate agents, you should be acting as a fiduciary, whether you're required to or not. And that referral business and repeat business is how you make a career out of it, not a, I survived a bad cycle. So it's in their best interest no matter what.
Real estate pros, it's time to ditch an outdated negotiation process and embrace the future with Final Offer. Agents using Final Offer are beating their local market average sale to list price by up to 7%. With real-time offer updates, searches you can share with your clients, and the ability to make an offer in seconds, Final Offer scales your business like never before. Visit finaloffer.com today. You You know, we did starting in 2021, I think we did a story about like who's gonna make it through this market and who's not, right? Who's gonna survive? It was a really interesting piece, and we've you know come back to it several times. At the time, people were different companies were going public, other companies were trying and failed, some companies decided not to. That was one of the touch points that we were looking at. In this environment, you know, we're seeing a completely different set of financial things going on, but it is interesting to me to see, you know, as we look back on this long term, like what were the decisions that led to the most success here? Was it indeed having this dual licensure, or was it instead showing real estate agents, we're going to be the people that when the chips are down, we are going to make sure that we're of value to you. We're not going to be a competitor to you.
I think there are a couple big themes here, and you hit it right on the head. The first is, do you see it as the originator's job to be of value to the agent, right? And if that is the case, then you don't want to work in a dual capacity. Obviously, that would not be serving your client, even if the borrower, you know, depending on the way you think about it. The other is maybe the ones who are the most successful in the next cycle are not the ones who worked best with the agents and who had really strong relationships with buy-side agents or whomever, but they're the ones who had direct dealings with the client and didn't need to rely on the generosity or, you know, the referral business from the buy-side agent. Or maybe it's a combination of that and mortgage loan originators who are cozying up to sell-side agents, because a lot of buyers are just going to say, I don't need representation, and they're going to depend on a professional to help them, even if they're not a real estate agent. Maybe they know an inspector, or maybe they know enough about how to kind of function and do some of that job. Maybe not all of it, maybe not at the level of service that they would have gotten had they taken the services of a buy-side agent, but can you do enough of it and also provide value as the originator? Maybe that's, you know, the way forward. So I think, yeah, it's going to really come down to kind of those two big questions. Is it whoever figures out how to do it themselves and get to the client, or are you just much better at identifying the buy-side agent and making sure that you're targeting the right people, not the buy-side agent who now no longer has clients or who doesn't have enough clients to give you the business you need to sustain your own operations?
Well, and obviously, like you said, as far as a scalable thing, that's why people do JVs, right? Is that it wasn't scalable to do both. So it's like, we're gonna have both, but we don't have the same people do both.
Yeah. And even more than just the JVs, there are so many MSAs out there between real estate offices and mortgage brokers and LOs. And, you know, I think a lot of those relationships are pretty questionable. I view a lot of them as on the line of quid pro quo, and the CFPB to date has not taken much interest in the MSAs, but certainly I would expect that there will be a lot more of these types of relationships in the future, assuming that we don't see, you know, a tremendous amount of interest from the CFPB within the next couple months. But the major X factor here, and I sound like a broken record because we talk about it so often, is the Department of Justice. And so a lot of this hinges on this idea that the buy-side agent is going to be, you know, I don't want to say less valuable, but when you change the dynamic and you make clear in the deal that the buyer is responsible for their own agent's comp, then I think, you know, you lose leverage, right? And the DOJ could look at the arrangement that the NAR has with the plaintiffs and say, you know what, I don't care if it's not on the MLS. The fact that you're able to advertise it on your own website or wherever is effectively the same thing as, you know, predetermining the compensation on the buyer side, and doesn't change the relationship and the financial handcuffs that you're kind of requiring clients to put on. And so we don't want any place where the buyer, you know, is already got their agent's comp determined, right? And so that will change if that were to happen. Then suddenly everybody's going to be texting and emailing. You know, you're not going to have a page where the buy side agent knows what the comp is. And so, you know, that could very significantly change what happens next. So we're all kind of like reading the tea leaves and thinking, okay, if the settlement does get approved by the judge and what the NAR and the plaintiffs have said is acceptable becomes de facto law, then here are the opportunities. But again, like, we don't know that those opportunities are ever going to happen because the DOJ carries a pretty big stick.
It really does. And it is, I agree with you, it is the X factor right now, something that maybe we didn't have to worry about so much in the past. But, you know, they've made it really clear that they are all up in this. They're looking at every part of this and feel like they have an important part to play, which can be, you know, very chaotic for if you're in the industry trying to make plans and you thought you had a settlement, for instance, and now it's like up in there. Do you have a settlement? Do you not have a settlement? What does that look like? No one knows. Well, James, thanks for so much for being on today and for the work that the newsroom's doing on this really important issue. Can't wait to read the article, but thanks for being on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Housing Wire Daily. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to take a minute to rate the show and leave a comment. And make sure to tune in tomorrow for more news and insight.